December 7th, 1941, a date which will live
in infamy.
It's Hardcore History.
The Blitz Edition.
If two boxers step into the ring together, and they are exactly the same height, weight, skill level, same conditioning, heck, trained by the same person. Imagine that basically all of those variables have been eliminated. What is going to be the likely deciding factor in which one of those two people wins that match? I want to take you through a little mental exercise that's similar to that same question. Instead of dealing with individuals, though, you're dealing more with, you know, giant, giant societies, groups of individuals. Imagine for a second that the United States of America today, this country we live in now, well, not those of you who live outside the country, but you could probably play this same mental exercise and come up with similar conclusions. Imagine we get involved in a war. One of those wars of the sort that we haven't been involved in since the Second World War. And really, let's be honest, weren't even involved in the Second World War. One of those wars that would give us an experience maybe more like the Germans or the Russians had in that war. I want you to imagine the kind of conflict where, you know, there's not going to be some peace settlement. It's going to be an unconditional surrender where the loser is going to have their cities laying in ruins, and the winner may have a few cities laying in ruins too. But not just that, but for the purposes of this mental exercise, you have to imagine this country that we get into war with is just like us in terms of the size of the country, the size of the population, the size of the military, the size of the economic output. They even have the same equipment we have. There's only one difference between this country we're fighting and us. The other country is made up of our grandparents. Could we beat our grandparents in a straight-up equal war? I have a feeling that the answer to this question is the same whether you're an American listening to this, or a European, or someone listening in Asia or South America, because it involves a certain truism that is hard to talk about, hard to quantify, and hard to deny. A question of toughness, a human quality that in our heads we all know is extremely important, but that would be difficult to weave into, you know, its proper place in a story. In a boxing match, it's really tough to say that, you know, Boxer A won because he was just tougher than Boxer B. Sounds like an insult to Boxer B, whether it's true or not. That's even harder to do when you're talking about giant societies. See, in our mental exercise involving our grandparents, think what's involved in this question, because that's what completely changed the direction of this show today. I was going to talk about the Achaemenid Persian Empire. This was before I realized how much of what I wanted to say crossed over with an earlier Hardcore History show we already did, and that's going to happen more and more as we do more of them. But it wouldn't have mattered anyway, because I got mentally sidetracked from this idea of the Achaemenid Persian Empire by this question I posed to you originally about, you know, a war against our grandparents. Think about what those people went through, first of all. You're talking about a generation that didn't just fight the Second World War, but that lived through a decade, maybe even more than a decade, of really hard economic times, some of the worst economic times in world history, modern world history. So those people get out of the Depression just in time to go into the Second World War. In fact, they actually cross over. For a time, you're in the Second World War and in the Depression. That's a 1-2 punch and out of the frying pan into the fire sort of experience. And there's a reason that that generation is proverbially thought of as tough. They're called the greatest generation, aren't they? I hate that sort of hyperbole, because there's certainly other generations all through history that would have matched them. But compared to us, they seem pretty darn tough, don't they? In a war, you know, no holds barred sort of conflict against those people, think about, you know, what we would have to put up with. First of all, could we handle the same kind of casualty numbers that they routinely handled. And we're talking Americans now. Imagine what the casualty numbers were for, you know, people in Germany and people in the Soviet Union and people in, you know, I mean, those numbers were really huge. Maybe you Germans and maybe you Russians and Ukrainians, you people should think a little bit about whether or not, you know, you could handle those kind of casualties either. But we certainly, you know, will have a hard time in this country when we have 12 guys in Iraq killed, usually because some mechanical failure in something like a helicopter. We don't even lose a lot of people to enemy action much anymore. And we'll lose 12 people, and it's a bit of a shock. And if you lose double that on a really bad day, that's a really bad day for us. I'm not sure those are numbers that our grandparents, really in my family, it's more my dad's older brother, he was in that war. But I mean, I don't think that the home front would have blinked at a 12, you know, KIA, killed in action day. Would we be able to suck up the kind of casualties they did? Especially when those casualties start rolling in and they're like of World War II or maybe even World War III level proportions. Could we handle that? And it's not just about whether or not you could, you know, weather the blows that they could handle. It's also about whether you could dish them out. Think about what those people had to do to win their war. Could we do that stuff? Think about the idea of strategic bombing. Another word for this used at the time was carpet bombing, where you would send up to, you know, 1,200 planes. Can you imagine 1,000 planes flying over your house, all of them loaded with tons of bombs? I mean, what if some of the planes would carry 20,000 pounds of bombs? You got 1,000 of them in the sky, darkening it. Or at night where you look up and you just know there's a wall, a solid wall of planes above you. And they're going to go to these cities, and they're going to indiscriminately bomb everything. Schools, hospitals, orphanages, they're going to bomb the very infrastructure, you know, the fire lines and the water mains and everything you would need to put out the very fires. You're going to start with those bombs. It's going to kill 10, maybe 15,000 people on a good or bad night, depending on how you view it. Civilians. And then you're going to go back in a couple of days and do it again. Could we do that? Our grandparents from many, many different countries proved that they certainly could. And what about the ultimate weapon? We get the atomic bomb, they get the atomic bomb. Could we use it? I mean, imagine today. Could you? I mean, I would have a hard time considering any sort of possible scenario you could throw at me where I would think, you know what, now's the time. Pull out the nuclear weapons and start firing them at those cities full of people. Using those nuclear weapons the same way we used the strategic bombers in the Second World War to just wipe cities off the map. Can you think of any scenario where you would think that was the proper course of action and you'd be willing to back it? Well, I guarantee you that public opinion polls during the Second World War would have found nowhere near a majority of people willing to say that the carpet bombing of Axis cities was wrong. Our grandparents could do that, and I think history shows that they could probably drop an atomic bomb on someone. Could we beat a people that tough in a war? Because when you think about it, at a certain point, we seem almost, I'm going to use an interesting word here, I think we seem almost too civilized now to do something that seems that barbaric. Now, in all credit to that generation, we're also not living through the same sorts of things that they lived through, and had we might be just as willing to do the same things they did. I think we have to acknowledge that. At the same time, this pattern that we may be living through is something that historians from the beginning of written history up until about 40 years ago, it's a process, would have no problem explaining. It is, however, a problem modern-day historians might have a very tough time explaining, and the word tough is one of the major reasons why. In an earlier show we did on the Great Depression, we asked whether or not you thought that tough times make tougher people. The idea that, you know, people are a little like a muscle, and when you put them under pressure and break them down, it improves their resiliency and their strength. Those of us who watched the people from the Great Depression live their lives saw all sorts of evidence all the time in little things that they did that they had been permanently changed and, I would suggest, toughened by the experience. The logical thing to ask, though, after you ask if tough times make tougher people, is the reverse question. Do easier times make softer people? Then the next question to ask is, if it applies to individuals, does it also apply to societies? Do a lot more tougher individuals living in a country make that a tougher country? Conversely, if over time you have a lot more individuals who are more soft, does that make your society softer? And the ultimate question you have to ask then is, does it matter? You know, toughness used to be a national security question when the laws governing international relations were more like the laws of the jungle. Perhaps we live in a time now where toughness simply doesn't matter as much as it used to. And if that's the case, we're free to enjoy a lot of advantages which have always come historically at a price, but which might be completely free today. Let me explain what I mean. One of the recurrent themes in history up until recently is this idea that civilization weakens certain human qualities. And those qualities throughout a lot of history were really important, and the main quality was toughness. You go back to some of the ancient Greek writers, you go into the era around Edward Gibbon's time in the 1700s, you go into the late 1800s, early 1900s with people like Hans Delbruck, you go to the middle 20th century with people like Chester Starr and Will Durant. None of those people have any problems discussing this idea that civilization takes the edge off human toughness. There's a line attributed to Voltaire, and I'm not sure he ever said it, but it's one of those meaningful lines, and it's so old now in and of itself, it's probably valuable. But the line is, and I'll probably butcher it, that human history is filled with the sound of silk slippers going downstairs and wooden shoes coming up. And what that's supposed to mean is that, you know, the luxurious life that civilizations give to their people, the silken shoes, are part of the downside of the cycle of civilizations, of empires specifically, and that those wooden shoes coming up the stairs represented the poorer people, the tougher people who were on their way up the ladder of civilization. We've said openly on this show before that I'm a fan of boxing, but the part I like least about it is the, you know, violence of it. The part I like the most is the same thing, I think, I hope, that, you know, literary figures have liked about that sport forever, and that's that it's a wonderful metaphor for so many things. And one of the things it's a metaphor for is this rise and fall of empires that used to be kind of thought of as a cycle by some of the earlier historians, because in boxing, if you watch it long enough, you get to see the rise and fall of human beings played out in front of you. And it's a similar sort of a road that they travel. It's a proverbial one, and it's a little bit simplified, but here's the way it goes. You get a young, hungry man, usually from poverty, and sometimes from a very rough upbringing, who decides he wants to be a boxer and devotes himself to this cause and goes to the gym and trains religiously and avoids all the wonderful temptations of life that a young person should be getting into because they're focused intently on this goal and self-denial is the name of the game and eating a certain diet and, you know, controlling their weight and focusing on a single-minded thing. And then all of that self-denial and work pays off when they win the championship someday. And then the winning of the championship in a very Greek-like way sows the seeds for their own downfall, because now they've got that long sought-after goal. Sometimes they're a little aimless. They've got the money that comes with it. They've got the, you know, the nightlife and the ability to slough off a little bit and still win over inferior opposition. And they begin to degenerate and decline. And then age begins to play a factor too. And let's not pretend that age doesn't have something to do with societies as well. And eventually, this great champion will lose to someone who looks a lot like they did before they won the championship. Sort of the life cycle of a human being played out in front of you in the career of your average boxer. But historians from the past often believed that nation states ran a similar course. Let me read you something written by one of the greatest historians of the 20th century, Will Durant. And he wrote this piece about the Medes, which were a people in the Middle East. We talked about them in our show on Assyria because they were one of the peoples that had banded together to take down the Assyrian menace. And the Medes were thought to be a relatively poor people, pastoral in a lot of cases, living a hardy sort of existence. And the way history portrays what happened to them after they helped throw down Assyria is the equivalent of a poor person, you know, buying a lottery ticket and winning the giant jackpot. They're supposed to run through the normal course of the life cycle of empires, you know, as though they're on steroids. And here's what Will Durant writes about them. And in this piece, he's talking about two of their kings. One is Cyaxares, and his son, the one who's portrayed as so degenerate, is Astyages. And here's what Durant writes in the post-war period in the 20th century about the Medes. Quote, "Their degeneration was more rapid than their rise. Astyages, who succeeded his father Cyaxares, proved again that monarchy is a gamble, in whose royal succession great wits and madness are near allied. He inherited a kingdom with equanimity and settled down to enjoy it. Under his example, the nation forgot its stern morals and stoic ways. Wealth had come too suddenly to be wisely used. The upper classes became the slave of fashion and luxury. The men wore embroidered trousers. The women covered themselves in cosmetics and jewelry. The very horses were often caparisoned in gold. These once simple and pastoral people, who'd been glad to be carried in rude wagons with wheels cut roughly out of the trunks of trees, now rode in expensive chariots from feast to feast." End quote. I can't imagine a modern historian writing anything like that. Is Durant, for example, saying that, you know, the Medes literally fell because the men were wearing embroidered pants and the women were wearing cosmetics and jewelry? No. He's, of course, talking about those things as outward signs of how they had changed. And how they had changed had eroded, corrupted, you know, siphoned off, tapped, sapped, whatever you want to say, the very qualities that had helped them to be tough enough to win this empire. That's a very, you know, judgmental thing to say when you think about it. This is a historian inserting his own opinion based on his own knowledge of history, which, let's admit, are greater than, you know, I imagine anyone listening to this voice will ever hope to have. This is Will Durant's opinion as to what happened here, and he's sort of giving you a lesson in larger history. But it's the sort of lesson no historian writing in the last 40 years would try to give you. Nowadays, history is a hard science, practically. They're very concerned, as they should be, with making sure that the facts are all correct and everything is peer-reviewed and radiocarbon dating is involved. And if you are concerned with knowing one of the most, maybe the most, important question history is supposed to answer, the question of what happened in the past, then today's historians are the best there have ever been. The thing is, though, that this has almost been a conscious decision by the great figures in modern history to move history in that direction. You can read stuff written in the United States, in Britain, in Europe, and other places where trying to make history more of a science has been an actual goal in the discipline for my entire lifetime. The movement itself is actually more than 100 years old, but it really took off about 40 years ago, turning history into more of what's called a social science. But in order to do that and become the most accurate historians that have ever lived, history was forced to leave behind some of the things it used to consider part of its job to deal with. The parts that used to make history part of the academic discipline we call the humanities instead of the sciences. And by the way, if you look at universities around the United States, history is still called part of the humanities more than it's called part of the sciences. And think about why it makes sense to put history in the category of the humanities a lot of the time. I almost think there should be two kinds of historians, the humanities kind and the scientific kind. And I find that when I read history books, you know, like I said, I was doing work on the Achaemenid Empire before I realized we'd done a lot of that before. And I was reading three or four different histories at once from three or four different eras about the same events. And I found that synthesizing them, you know, kind of taking them together as a whole was very valuable. But leaving any of those pieces out, I felt, would sort of cheat your overall experience in trying to, you know, see different points of view and understand different things. And one of the things you'd be cheated is not having Will Durant's point of view that, you know, part of what comes into play are the human questions. Things that are very hard for a scientist to quantify. How do you quantify all of the variations inherent in us? Our emotions and our actions and our motivations and those sorts of things defy real scientific work, don't they? And data collection and studies and laboratory replication. Some parts of history fit into that realm rather nicely, economics, for example, and you go back and see, well, this empire lost important trade routes, and that precipitated a decline in funds, which precipitated a crisis in the army, and you can do that all day long, and it's wonderful work. But it doesn't explain every situation. It wouldn't have explained why that one boxer who was exquisitely matched with that other boxer, and the only quality that separated them was who was going to give up last. Toughness, a human element that fits much more properly into the question of the humanities. And if you look at the other subjects in the humanities, you can see why an issue like that would, you know, fit the old style history better. The humanities deals with all those kinds of subjects that are so hard for science to deal with. How about literature, law, sometimes art and music? How about religion? And most importantly, when it comes to the question of history, the humanities deals with subjects like philosophy. Philosophy and history are more related than most people think. As a matter of fact, when you start dealing with the very highest levels of history, the lines between history and philosophy cross, and the distinctions blur. And when you read Will Durant, you get a healthy dose of philosophy. When you read a modern history, you don't. That's what's changed in the history discipline in my lifetime. And it's mostly good, and the information's much better, and it's all peer-reviewed and all that stuff, and a lot less bias. But when I read a Will Durant, I get something that I don't get from the modern-day histories. I get lessons. And herein lies part of the problem. There's an old line about history, and it's been attributed to a bunch of different people, Thucydides probably most of all, an early historian. And Thucydides is supposed to have said that history is philosophy taught by example. And this goes along with what one of my history teachers told me in my very early college days. And she said that there are two ways human beings learn in this life. One is to touch a hot stove and burn themselves and learn never to touch that hot stove again. The other is to read or hear about somebody else touching a hot stove and thereby get all the benefits of that same lesson without having to go through any of the pain. That's considered to be the superior way to learn things. The roots of the words philosophy and the understanding of history in the past are connected. It's all about acquiring wisdom. And one of the main ways you acquire wisdom is through experience. And you can acquire experience by burning yourself on the hot stove or by reading about someone else doing it. This is the old style view of history. Things like values and lessons and the judgments of historians are thoroughly out of date now. But what that means is you lose some of that stuff they used to give you. Those judgments used to be valuable. Let me read you a quote from a famous Roman historian, and we used his stuff for our Punic War shows. He's known as Livy to us now. And Livy said something that perfectly matched the old histories, but doesn't really match the ones now. He said, quote, "The study of history is the best medicine for a sick mind. For in history you have a record of the infinite variety of human experience, plainly set out for all to see. And in that record, you can find yourself and your country both examples and warnings, fine things to take as models, base things rotten through and through to avoid." End quote. See, those are the kinds of judgments a modern historian would not feel comfortable making. And they wouldn't feel comfortable making it because it opens the door to all sorts of bias, doesn't it? Not just the bias of the individual historian, but the bias of the era that they write in. You are corrupted by your times, and it influences the way you write. And this has turned off a lot of modern-day historians to reading the historians of the past. Once you realize how biased man can't help but be with a subject as varied as history, where you can cherry-pick all the little facts and ideas you want to back up any point you want to make, well, it makes the only thing worth studying, the stuff you can, you know, radiocarbon date or dig out of the ground, the ideas of theorizing and philosophizing about what history means is from a different era of history writing. But what if the right answer of what happened in history is sometimes better explained by the old historians than the new ones? For example, Will Durant could have written the history of that fictional war we talked about at the beginning of the show. You know, the America of 2010's loss to our grandparents. I can almost in my mind, you know, as much of a Durant reader as I am, I can almost hear how he would have phrased it too. You know, he would have said something like, the 21st century technological advances had created a people who were weaker in body from working and playing on computers all day, and overweight from a sedentary lifestyle, as well as being untested by harsh conditions. No match for a people raised in the hard-scrabble existence of a Depression-era world of want and hardship, a world of hard physical labor and more stoic values of thrift and duty. That's how he would put it. And part of you winces at that because, you know, what a judgment on us that is. At the same time, I have a feeling many of us probably think in our heads, there's something to that. I mean, think about it this way. How would Americans today react if we were told next week that we're going to reinstitute the military draft? A nationwide, permanent draft where everybody serves 3 or 4 years in the military, you know, right out of high school. I'm not sure you can imagine the violence that would erupt in this country from a move like that. If anything would be calculated to actually get Americans up off their rear ends and into the streets, it's the, you know, potential to get Americans to get up off their rear ends and serve 4 years in the military, you know, mandatorily. People in this country in the 1950s didn't blink at that requirement. Didn't blink at that requirement. Part of their civic duty. That's a perfect example of how we've changed, right? I think a Will Durant or a Hans Delbruck or any of those guys could have explained these issues in a way that described the decline in American toughness. Modern historians would be much more squeamish about that. That's a hard thing to measure. It's a hard thing to study. It's a hard thing to put your finger on. And it's a hard thing to say without being judgmental. It's a little too amorphous for a scientist to start talking about. And it opens the door to all sorts of bias and judgments by the historian that is looked at today as part of the problem in historical writing, you know, from the past. Can't trust that stuff. It's all bias through the eye of the historian and also corrupted by, you know, their day. But here's where the part of the historian as the philosopher comes in for me. The way those two subjects are linked requires a little bit of art to do their job well. You know, history today is like news reporting in the sense that the job of the historian is to get the facts. But many of us like to have and see value in having someone you would call a news analyst, someone whose job it is to look at the news in its entirety and explain the bigger picture of what it means. A person who's been following news for a very long time maybe has a gift for it. And yes, it involves opinion, but with opinion sometimes comes insight. And these historians of the past, like Will Durant, strike me as historical commentators. And in some ways, that puts them in the position of giving an opinion, in the same way that we watch political commentators, and some of them ring true to you and others seem like nuts. I think you need to think of historical writing from the humanities side of the ledger in a similar vein. It's kind of opinion, and certain ones will appeal to you more than others, depending on your point of view. Here's the thing, though. Philosophy is the same way, and people don't talk about writing off all the philosophers because it's all based on opinion. We all know that there's 1,000 crackpot philosophies out there, but that doesn't prevent you from, you know, appreciating someone like Socrates. Usually, there are people in any field who are supremely gifted and stand head and shoulders above the rest. When Einstein was involved in physics, he was ahead of the game. You respect a guy like that. And as a matter of fact, when they looked at Einstein's brain, I think I have this correct, when they looked at Einstein's brain after he died, there seemed to be a part of his brain that was, you know, a physical part of his brain that was more developed than your average human beings, might have been one of those genetic mutations which are really at the core of the idea of natural selection and moving forward, right? You got to have, you know, one moth that gets the white coloring that eventually becomes what all the moths who survive, you know, maintain, and you have a white moth at the end because there was that first moth that was white and it turned out to be better. I think you get an Einstein in the field of physics who does that for you at one time. I think you get a Socrates in the field of philosophy that does that for you. And I think you get the same thing in a lot of other genres, history included. There's a lot of crackpot histories out there, but there's also people like Will Durant who are wonderful and who obviously have talents above and beyond your average historian. And by the way, there must be something about, you know, looking at the vast growth of history and seeing these kinds of patterns, because this is not a Western historian thing. You can go read the early Islamic historians. You can go read the Chinese historians. And they all kind of feel like they have their pulse on certain human cycles and rhythms that reoccur throughout history. They're a little bit different from each civilization, but this whole idea of toughness and civic virtue, you know, rising as the civilization, you know, progresses and then falling as the civilization declines, that's something historians throughout all eras have noticed. So it's not confined to, say, the Greeks or the Romans or the Europeans. This is something historians think they see. And the reason, though, that such things like the life cycle of history is thoroughly discredited is because the people that like to push it and have in the past like to push it as though it's some sort of immutable law of history. And of course, history doesn't work that way. You may try to cram as many examples you can cherry pick from history into your little life cycles of empire model. Doesn't mean it really works. And the truth is, you can go read some of the latest works on these rise and fall issues, questions of societal collapse. Jared Diamond's book Collapse deals with them. And at the end of Collapse, he gives 5 or 6 reasons society fails. So instead of just trying to come up with something like a life cycle of empires, one rule that governs everything, Diamond finds 5 or 6 categories that everything fits into. And to be honest, that doesn't even cover everything in work. Empires are composed of people. People are notoriously variable. There is no rule of history that works every time. What's more, a lot of your historians today are very focused on little teeny niches. I'm an expert on the French Revolution. I know more about the French Revolution than anyone, anywhere, at any time. Yes, but to do that, they give up knowledge of all the rest of, you know, Sumeria and the early growth of cities and writing. And I mean, the historians that really have this gift for analyzing what they're dealing with, looking at long-term human trends and trying to make sense of them, are the ones who study history from the beginning of time up until recently and everything in between. And usually also a wide variety of stuff, arts and political histories and environmental history and a wide variety of stuff. And that's when you trust someone as gifted as a Will Durant to look at history from the beginning to the end and say, here's what I see. And not just what they see, but what conclusions they draw. The conclusions are the part where, you know, history becomes an art. There's a line from a guy named George Trevelyan where he said, quote, "Let the science and the research of the historian find the fact, and let his imagination and art make clear its significance," end quote. Now, that's the way it used to be. Take a guy like Chester Starr, who was writing a lot of his works in the mid-1960s, which is a period of transition from the old-style humanities history to the new style. So he's got all these wonderful facts and everything you would want, talking about the latest information in a very scientific and modern way, but he still throws in those conclusions. For example, he talks about the Spartans. We all know the Spartans, right? This is a whole culture and society that is geared toward creating the finest fighting man in the ancient world. And it's an interesting relationship between the culture, the fighting man, and the state, because the fighting men of Sparta propel this Peloponnesian Greek city-state to heights it never had any right to expect based on its population numbers, its economic output, its agrarian, you know, nothing. Sparta was who and where it was because they had the best fighting men of Greece. And they had the best fighting men in Greece because the whole culture and society of Sparta worked to create them. And it starts at the very beginning, doesn't it? The first thing a newborn Spartan baby has happened to it is it gets judged by the elders. That council of Spartan people who take a look at a child newly born and decide whether or not it's fit enough to continue on. And if they decide it's not, it's proverbially said, it's thrown over the cliff. So right from the very beginning, Sparta is looking at its newborns as raw material for its military, and that raw material is then honed, and the kids are off fighting with sticks, you know, in camp when they're 7. They're eating in mess halls with their brethren on the battlefield. They're eating gruel. They're hunting helots to keep, you know, the edge. The helots were the slave population in Sparta. I mean, there were a lot of things in Spartan society designed to keep these Spartans tough. I mean, through most of the early classical history of Sparta, they didn't even have money in Sparta, we're told. You can't be corrupted by money if you don't have any. And what happens to Sparta is the same kind of story that Will Durant tells you about the Medes. Chester Starr tells you how the Spartans degenerated over time. His exact quote is that they became, quote, luxury-loving and corruptible, end quote. See, and if you don't think that can happen, it's a little like saying, you know what, Sparta didn't need to do any of those things to stay tough. They didn't need to judge the babies, and they didn't need to have the harsh conditions and the training as a child and not letting the Spartans marry till they got it. If they hadn't done anything at all, the Spartans would be just as tough as if they, you know, went through this whole Spartan system. And of course, that's nonsense. But what you're saying there, then, is you're backing up this idea that people can be tougher or not tough, and that this toughness can be the deciding factor in a lot of cases, like whether or not you have, you know, the best soldiers in the ancient world or not. Because if Sparta doesn't have the best soldiers in the ancient world, you probably never know who they are. And if you look at the Spartans over time, the Spartans of 380 BCE would probably not have beaten their grandfathers of 480 BCE. And I pretty much guarantee you the Spartans of 280 BC would not have beaten their grandfathers. And by then, of course, the Spartans had money and all kinds of things. I mean, the Persian gold, if nothing else, had done a pretty good job turning them into the equivalent of modern-day politicians. They were not the same people. And on the battlefield, when push came to shove in these ancient battles, which were as frightening as anything human beings have ever participated in, you know, that toughness became a national security issue. It's interesting, though. Star saying that the Spartans declined because they became corruptible and luxury-loving, that's a little like philosophy or religion, isn't it? I mean, we're getting that guy's point of view, and there's kind of a moral tinge to the message, which is sort of like, you know, make sure you don't follow this same path or you too will degenerate and decline. We are not a people in this modern times that can hear such a message and take it very well. That sort of moralizing has fallen out of favor and is part of an earlier age. It's something that is missing in modern society, but that, you know, ancient societies, for example, societies throughout most of history have had, you know, that philosopher class. Those people whose job it was to take a look at society and comment on it. That's sort of been parceled out to a bunch of different professions in modern societies. Sort of a pity in one sense, because I think we miss it as a society. But at the same time, I think I'd probably be just like the rest of you, and we'd mock all these people as moralists and do-gooders and interferers in the lives of others. I mean, we just don't have that kind of culture anymore. But of course, we may be part of the silk slipper crowd heading down the stairs. Here's the good news if we are on the downside of civilization, you know, and that there is this pattern and we're on it and we're on the downslope of it. That's the fun side to be on. I mean, I think if you were choosing, you know, what sort of era you'd like to live your life in, this is the more fun one. You just don't want to be there at the very end. So the logical question to ask when you start talking about, you know, being there at the end when, you know, civilization takes a dive is why aren't we there now? If the tougher civilizations and the tougher peoples naturally take over, and we aren't at our toughest, why are we still here? For that kind of information, you have to turn to different historians from the humanities. A good example would be the German military historian Hans Delbruck from the turn of the last century. Delbruck has such a fabulous mind that, you know, in the movie Young Frankenstein, when Igor is getting the brain that Dr. Frankenstein wants to put in his creation, he starts with Hans Delbruck's brain. And then, of course, he drops it on the floor and has to use the replacement. But that just shows you, you know, Hans Delbruck's brain is marvelous, marvelous mind. His history is 100 years old and out of date in so many respects, but there's, you know, the one factor you can't replace is Hans Delbruck. And his theory is that all of the various things that a modern military does, everything from the organization, the tactics, the drill, the logistics, the leadership, the whole thing is designed to help offset the natural advantage that the toughness of people at a lower level of civilization possess. And just so you don't think he was some colonial racist talking about tribal peoples in Africa or in other regions where Europeans at the time were dominating through military superiority, Hans Delbruck had a very soft spot in his heart for the ancient Germans and was often writing from a position where he liked them best. So he favored these tribal barbarians and was trying to explain why these more civilized, refined Romans kept beating them. Here's what Delbruck wrote, quote, "Compared to civilized people, barbarians had the advantage of having at their disposal the warlike power of the unbridled animal instincts, of basic toughness, Civilization refines the human being, makes him more sensitive, and in doing so it decreases his military worth, not only his bodily strength, but also his physical courage. These natural shortcomings must be offset in some artificial way. Scharnhorst was perhaps the first one to state that the main service of the standing army consists of making civilized people, through discipline, capable of holding their own against the less civilized. End quote. By Del Brooke's way of thinking, the whole reason that city-states first start organizing their, you know, agricultural farmers, who maybe aren't as tough as those tough nomadic barbarians right outside their borders, you organize your farmers into a superior military formation that requires training and discipline like the phalanx, and that gives you your initial advantage that lets you hold your own against those tough goat herders, you know, right outside your city walls that threaten your way of life. So you look at a place like Afghanistan right now. Imagine the war that we in the West are fighting in Afghanistan if we had to use the same weapons that the Afghans have. Afghanistan is another good example of a place that is known for its toughness and the toughness of its people and their resiliency, right? They have a tradition and a reputation, but our society is not Afghan society. And I think if you gave us AK-47s and, you know, IEDs and said, fight this war with the Afghans, it would be a very interesting conflict to see how it turned out. Might be a little like fighting our grandfathers. The next question I think that logically springs to mind is, if all this technology and military organization and logistics and systems and all this stuff can make up for the lack of toughness, why do you need the toughness at all? Can't you just sort of become this very, very civilized, technically sophisticated people who can keep degenerating in the toughness category? Because you don't need to be tough. You have technology. Well, there are some wonderful examples that kind of show that in history, there's a limit to how long technology can make up for your toughness. At a certain point, the individual comes into play once again, that human element. When I was doing the research for the Achaemenid Persian Empire show, I thought I was going to do, I was rereading Xenophon about the Persians, and he's a wonderful source, unless you want to write him off for being biased. See, that's how you write off all the early sources. But Xenophon actually fought for the Persians in a war. He was part of the famous 10,000 Greek mercenaries. He wrote a book called The Anabasis, where he recounts this amazing story of being trapped in the middle of Persia after being on the losing side in a Persian civil war, and he and his Greeks marching all the way back from the middle of Persia back to Greek territory, harried by the Persians the whole way. But it was seen as a sign of the Persians' military decline that those Greeks were able to get away. How could they possibly get away from the center of Persia? Xenophon wrote a whole epilogue and then a whole nother book with the sole purpose of trying to convince a Greek audience that Persia was not as tough as she used to be and was ripe for the taking. And he was only one of many Greek thinkers at the time that kept preaching a crusade against Persia, not so much because of, you know, reasons of justice that they would talk about, but because Persia was the equivalent of Turkey. You know, when the First World War rolled around, they were calling Turkey the sick man of Europe at the time. Just seemed like it was a house of cards, and any country that could get there would have all of Turkish holdings, you know, for its own. It was ripe. It was ready to fall. It was in decline. And Xenophon's work is an example of one of the Greek works that tried to explain, yes, it's in decline, and here's why it's in decline. And Xenophon relates a story from the Battle of Cunaxa that he fought in that shows you why military technology can only compensate for this human factor toughness for so long. Here's what he writes about the moment at Cunaxa, just before his Greek hoplites smash into the oncoming Persian infantry. Quote, "By now the two armies were not more than between 600 and 800 yards apart, and now the Greeks sang the paean and begun to move forward against the enemy. As they advanced, part of the phalanx surged forward in front of the rest, and the part that was left behind began to advance at the double. At the same time, they all raised a shout, like the shout of Ilaliu, which people make to the war god, and then they were all running forward. Some say that to scare the horses, they clashed their shields and spears together. But the Persians, even before they were in range of the arrows, wavered and ran away." End quote. If that was the only example of similar Persian behavior from this part of the empire and later, then, you know, we could write off what Xenophon was saying as some sort of propaganda meant to denigrate a people he didn't like. But from all accounts, he did like the Persians, enjoyed serving with them, and what he was essentially saying is, you can give the Persians all the best weapons you want. They no longer are the kind of people willing to stand up there and use them. They didn't even come into contact with his phalanx, which is not something that would have happened during the time of Cyrus, Kurosh, the founder of the Persian Empire, their version of George Washington or King Arthur, who 150 years before this period also fought Greek hoplites, and his troops didn't run away. The Persians who fought at the Battle of Canoxa in 401 BC would not have beaten their grandfathers. And 60 years after this time period, you know, they'll run into Alexander the Great, and the infantry will put on an even poorer performance. And after two battles of getting smashed by, you know, the most superior military machine in the world, the Macedonian is probably the more correct way to pronounce it, army, the king of Persia, who also was not as tough as his forebears, he ran away from the two battles that he fought in. He didn't even fight. As soon as the Macedonians made progress, he turned around and fled, and his army followed him. He was symptomatic of everything that had changed in that empire where the king was supposed to be in the front ranks, and their founder Cyrus died in a battle against the Massageti people, you know, died fighting. They had to recover his body. Darius III at Issus and Gaugamela was taking no chances. He was on the first horse out of there as soon as things seemed a little bit hot. Darius had figured out a couple of things. First of all, the Persians knew since the Greek and Persian Wars that their people were not as tough as the Greeks in the hand-to-hand fighting category anymore. So their answer to that was to simply, you know, purchase Greeks. They used tons of Greek mercenaries, and that was how you compensated for this hole in your army. You did not have hand-to-hand combat infantry that could stand up to what your enemies were using, so you simply hired them. And that's a solution that many of the great powers, and the more civilized the powers, the more they seem to do this, have done throughout history. You can look all across the world and see examples of great civilized powers whose people had maybe been a little refined by civilization, bolstering their military forces by bringing in large numbers of these people who lived at a tougher existence level because they made such good fighters. Look at the people that the Islamic armies often turn to. In the Middle East, they often turn to the Bedouin nomads, the tough Bedouins, or the Central Asian Turkic-type tribes themselves. In Egypt, they forever have turned to the Nubians living south of them to put in their armies and help toughen them up. The Chinese and the Byzantines both employed very large numbers of steppe warriors, very tough, hardy, nomadic troops from the wastelands of Central Asia. Natural warriors. The Romans used Celts and then Germans, all people that originally made their armies tougher, and you couldn't even tell a Celt or a German from a Roman citizen or a North African Roman in those days. They all looked the same until the army had so many, you know, what were called barbarians in it, that it became more of a barbarian army than a Roman one. But when the Romans tried to infuse more toughness and more soldiery into their ranks, they were simply doing what, you know, empires throughout history have done. I mean, you could go even up until much more recent times and look at people like the Gurkhas' role in the British army as just, you know, a single example. Highlanders throughout history have been used in armies to help toughen them up and act as scouts. And so if you can't manufacture your own tough raw materials for soldiery, or you can't manufacture enough of them, you can always purchase some outside help from people who weren't raised with so many of the refinements, the softening refinements of civilization. The Persian attempt to try to create their own hoplites and phalangites along the lines of Alexander's troops, that was sort of a last-ditch effort, and it wasn't tried till the last battle. By the way, there's another historical example of that. When the Roman legions were dominating the Mediterranean world, other world powers started trying to find, you know, centurions and people they could hire away from Rome and have them train their own troops to be legionaries, and several countries have, at that time, what's called imitation legionaries, and they learned the same lesson that Darius III learned when he tried to re-equip some of his Persian troops for the last battle, more like the Greeks. You could give them the spears, you could give them the armor, you could give them the training, But at the very end game, when one spear block was about to run head-on into another spear block, what really mattered was the person underneath the helmet. The Persians from 200 years before, in Cyrus's day, would have stood there. The Persians of 480 in the Greek and Persian Wars did stand there and fight the Spartans in hand-to-hand combat. The Persians of 401 BC and Alexander's day wouldn't stand there anymore. Just because, you know, you equip and train them the same doesn't mean they're going to fight that way. Imagine giving, you know, me and my wife and our neighbors a bunch of, you know, modern weaponry and then telling us to go out and fight real soldiers. I have a feeling most of us would simply drop our weapons and run away at the first sign of real stress and danger. And eventually, you know, as Xenophon said in his book, he said the Persian soldiers are made up now of slaves and grooms and people who are thrown in there so that the actual Persian, you know, nobles don't have to do the work anymore. This is a similar way to the way Rome got at the end, where Italians didn't want to have anything to do with serving in the military. They were, you know, pottery makers, and they were sculptors, and they were artists, and they, you know, were janitors and had regular lives and got their food at the food store, just like we do. Last thing they wanted to do was go fight some tribal barbarian, you know, who's counting the number of heads he's cut off in his life so far, and that's a point of pride to him. The Persians didn't want to face those murderous Macedonians, people that the other Greeks thought were a little barbarous, and who can blame them? Now, it should be pointed out that even once you have the troops, that doesn't mean, you know, if you're born tough and raised tough, doesn't mean you have a tough soldier. You still have to protect this, you know, edge, this quantity that makes these people so valuable. And commanders from these civilized states throughout history have often made sure not to allow their wonderfully tough troops to stay too long in areas that are too civilized and that might corrupt them with their, you know, luxury and offers of temptation. The Mongol armies of Genghis Khan were famous for being rapers and looters and pillagers and all that kind of stuff. But once Genghis's descendants conquer China, which had been one of the main long-term goals of the entire Mongol Empire, and they settle down to rule China, now they're ruling Asia's version, in some cases, of the flesh pots of Babylon. And the Mongol rulers, people like Kublai Khan, who was Genghis's grandson, issues edicts saying that their rough nomadic horse archer warriors who are so tough can't stay stationed in the Chinese cities for more than about 6 months at a time. And after that, they have to be rotated back out to the harsh, you know, steppes, the wasteland of the steppes, to re-toughen them back up. And so we had this constant rotation going with the tough troops coming into the city. They get a little relaxed, and then, boom, they're sent right back out. It'd be like, you know, if your soldiers were stationed in New York City or Chicago or Los Angeles or, you know, New Orleans, and then you have to rotate them out to places like, you know, Omaha and Iowa City and Ames and Butte. Places more in the center of the country where you can really get a good night's sleep on a regular basis. And the funny thing about places like Rome, and you see this in China too and other places where, you know, you can actually watch your army decline as it's exposed to more of that corrupting, civilized influence. It doesn't take generations. It can happen, you know, with a single person, a little like watching those boxers decline. For example, in the Roman Empire, at a certain point in the empire's history, you basically have what's known as a Western army, which is based in Europe around Italy, you know, the traditional Roman area of operations, and you have an Eastern army based in the very urban, very civilized, very corrupting East, you know, in what's now the modern Middle East, with all the wonderful cities and literally the flesh pots of Babylon and all that stuff. And for a very long time, the conventional wisdom in Rome is that the Western army, based in this much more rural, much more, you know, down-to-earth, not so tempting, not so corrupting, not so civilized area, is the tougher legion. The Romans should have rotated the legionaries the way the Mongols did. As I said earlier, I think we're on the preferable side of this cycle of history, assuming that one exists, the fun side, the one that it's more pleasurable to live in. But what if you decided that this was a bad place to be and you wanted to turn the clock back in terms of toughness? You see a problem and you're going to fix it. And the problem, unfortunately, revolves around the same thing that history as a humanities revolves around, you know, human beings. Can you make people tougher? And can you make society tougher? Well, the attempts to do so fall into a category of things called social engineering. using the flips and levers and power of society to try to mold human beings into some form you want them into. And I think we've seen examples of that in the 20th century. You don't even have to go too far back. The Nazis themselves were working on some form of social engineering. And the ideology of Adolf Hitler, you know, people love to try to categorize it as right or left or authoritarian or fascist, throw all kinds of words on it. The more you read Adolf Hitler's stuff, the more you think there is no category for the beliefs of the Nazi Party. They get almost mystical when you get into them, you know, deeply enough. And there's elements of paganism and elements, this whole idea of creating a new man based on going back and resurrecting ancient German warrior virtues. It's a very weird idea, but you could see how the wrong reading of history, here's a good lesson that modern scientific historians might say we learn from relying too much on the wrong historians, but deciding that, you know, Germany is on this life cycle of history and they need to toughen up, so we're going to toughen up with everything from exercise programs that are mandatory to new cultural messages that we spread with propaganda to try to desensitize the people and make what used to be considered to be brutal into a virtue. And not forgetting the idea that you might be able to make a tougher people. They would match up what they consider to be the perfect male and perfect female specimens and try to start a breeding program to, you know, change the DNA at the same time. Change the DNA, change the culture, change the messages, and then send them to Nazi youth camps to infuse them with these virtues. It's like a grand human experiment. And there's a part of you that thinks that's fascinating if it happened 2,000 years ago when we weren't living with the ramifications of something like that today. Can you turn back the clock on toughness? Well, I think the Nazi experiment and several others show us that it's so riddled with the potential for abuse and blowback and unforeseen consequences that I think it's perfectly correct that we consider such things to be, you know, a form of, you know, evil and wrong, although I'm sure there are elements of social engineering that we do today. See, the Nazis were worried about something. They needed a tougher people because they had a plan, and that plan revolved around military conquest, and as we talked about earlier, military virtues and toughness are almost synonymous. Do we need to have those things that the Nazis thought were so important to reinvigorate their society with? Do you have to be tough in the modern world? I have a weird question, and I don't mean anything offensive by it. Why is there a Belgium? Why is there a Luxembourg? Why are there, you know, 50, 60, 70 countries like that on the planet? Those are small, easily conquerable countries in areas that people, you know, would actually want to own those countries. They're not in the middle of nowhere up on some mountain plain or in some desert. Belgium's beautiful. A lot of people would want Belgium. And in most of human history, where, as we said earlier, the laws that governed relationships between nations were a little like the laws that govern, you know, the relationships between animals on Africa's Serengeti Plain, a place like Belgium would either be a protectorate of one of the great powers or a province of one. The reason that Belgium is neither is because we live in a time period right now, and depending on your point of view, you may say that this is a permanent development in human progress, or you may say that we live in a temporarily not dark age, where the normal rules of history are currently suspended. And as long as they are suspended, we will continue to have a bunch of countries that would not survive on the Serengeti Plain if there wasn't, you know, some sort of system regulating who ate whom. And that's not to question the toughness of the Belgians. I think they fall into the same category the rest of us do. I don't think they'd beat their grandparents in a war. But they're likely to not see such a war, so they get to enjoy all of the acknowledged upsides of civilization, and even some of the things that the moralist historians of the past would consider to be some of the downsides, the fun, the debauchery, the decadence, whatever, and not have to pay the historical price, you know, that other empires that went that route had to pay. And if that's true, we're entering into an era that man has rarely, if ever, ventured into before. This idea that you don't have to pay for the civilization party with a, you know, toughness-related hangover afterwards, where we're free to enjoy levels of civilization that would have undermined the toughness of the people of the past so much that it may have been suicidal. If toughness is no longer a national security question, That opens up all sorts of avenues that, you know, people of the past didn't have available to them. And I would think that this would be a very interesting historical development. Almost like that idea you hear sometimes where people will pose one of their theories on the end of history because some recurring cycle or pattern or thing we've lived with forever is gone now. I would make the case that if this really is the case, this is kind of like an end of history, or at least a, you know, long-term suspension of it. If that's the case, shouldn't the historians be talking about this? Well, here's the thing. I'm not sure this subject really falls into the modern discipline of history anymore. Our historians today do the best work at facts that's ever been done, but this really isn't even a question of facts. And it's not quite a history, it's not quite a philosophy, it's not quite something dealing with the classics. It falls into a sort of a academic discipline black hole. It doesn't fit anywhere anymore. But that's exactly the sort of question that would have fallen right into the lap of the old-style historians. Their job was more than just tell you the what happened. They wanted to tell you the why, and they wanted to tell you what it meant. Here's the thing, though. What you're going to get from them is going to just be an opinion, but it's going to be an expert opinion. And I've always been one of those people that valued an expert's opinion.
If you think the show you just heard is worth a dollar, Dan and Ben would love to have it. A buck a show. It's all we ask.
For Hardcore History t-shirts or other merchandise, go to dancarlin.com.
Make sure to do your Amazon.com shopping through the Amazon search window on dancarlin.com. You get the same great Amazon shopping experience, and Dan and Ben get a piece of the action from Amazon for sending you there. Go to dancarlin.com for information on how to donate to the show.